Okay.
Well, let's. I suppose we better get back to this elementary ed thing then.
Right. What sort of influence was, if any, the Department of Public Instruction then on the construction of your program? I mean, did they constrain you in the kinds of choices that you would have liked to have made? See, the reason being that we've been talking about academic versus the professional, and wanting to have teachers who are, you know, broadly trained, and yet also you must have realized that most of the people who have chosen elementary education as a group were probably not as academically skilled, perhaps, as people who were choosing secondary education. At least that's part of the traditional picture.
I think that has been the trouble right along. At that time, and I can't remember who was superintendent of schools at the time, but at that time, one of the things that John Guy did so very, very well, he was a consummate politician, and I would say that the educational institution of this state was very tightly bound up. The State Department at the Capitol and the School of Education at the university were very closely related, and we just didn't have any problems of that sort. If there were any, they were solved by rather small groups of people talking to one another in the dean's office or up at mm-hmm. the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And I recall very few, if any, problems that were brought up to the committee as stemming from objections or points of view at the Capitol. I really think that the relationships were so close that undoubtedly John Guy and Herrick and one or two others undoubtedly kept the state superintendent's office very closely informed and didn't really have any public exchange. We would prefer this, you prefer mm-hmm. that, we have a problem.
Right.
It was very closely just practically members of the committee, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the first place, the idea of the improvement academically of an elementary program was very highly sought after. People hoped it could be done. There was the hope, among other things, that we would attract a group of students who were more academically interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obvious from ILS idea and that sort of thing. That was a noble approach, I think.
Well, that was true. It was felt that there was a general feeling that the kind of people who had in the past always gone into elementary education, because they had a feeling that they couldn't make it in more rigorous courses,
mm-hmm.
were not the kinds of people we hoped to have come here. We hoped that a group of people would come, including a considerable number of men. That was another point. We hoped, in that case, that there would be a greater number of men coming into the program.
Now, having gone through actually the program myself and recently being an undergraduate, when one looks at a program, one often looks at the requirements to see how demanding it is. I mean, you kind of judge a program on what it requires.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I have always noticed, and it was true of the elementary ed program at that time, was that the math requirement seemed rather out of line with the way the rest of the university was going. That is rather weaker kind of a thing. It seemed that it was, you know, you set up a special course for elementary
for the
teachers
math. Mm-hmm.
For math.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that done? I mean, who was behind that? Or
I know that at the time it was done for the simple reason that a great many of the people who knew the temper of those who entered the elementary course was that if they didn't do it, they would simply not find enough takers to make it worthwhile to open the course.
Mm-hmm.
That they had to do it, that the people that would come would have to be treated that way as far as math was concerned.
Well, why didn't they just ask them to take an ordinary math course? As it was a mathematics course, why weren't they just simply required to complete whatever normal degree requirements there were for mathematics?
I don't really remember. I don't remember whether that was because they felt they wouldn't get the kind of students who were capable of taking an ordinary course. I think there was something said that the great majority of people who entered elementary programs throughout the state simply hadn't taken enough high school math to be eligible to enter such a course to begin with, and that therefore they would need to begin at a lower level because they lacked the high school preparation.
But with what you're talking about is the UW program being somewhat different and more selective, didn't people feel they could afford to?
I guess they did not. At least they didn't in that area.
Right. In looking through the documents, you know, they have various arguments about why we should have elementary education. You know, why do it now?
Right.
Most of them, I think, are fairly transparent. But one comment was the tremendous need for teachers and that sort of thing. But why was it that the program at UW was started up at this point rather than simply, say, expanding the program at Platteville or at Whitewater or other places like that?
Well, if that was the only reason, then that would have been the answer.
Uh-huh.
Now, the reason that I assumed had some validity to it was this, among other things. We do have a very large, for its activity, we do have a very large ed administration program. And the reason that was advanced frequently regarding them, and it seemed to me valid, I don't know, maybe it isn't, seemed valid, was that when people come here to work in ed administration, there ought to be an elementary ed program in which they can both participate and observe, because so many of them will go back into administration on the elementary level. Now, that makes sense, I think. There was also another idea, which does make some sense, for instance, in the art department, that there ought to be in the art department some classes dealing with elementary education people, so that an art department, a music department, even a dance department, a drama, should have some experience in preparing the general elementary education major for some concepts in the visual arts and drama or whatever you will. That makes some sense.
How did the faculty in art react to those kinds of...
Well, the faculty in art, of course, is totally uninterested in all of those things, but the faculty in art education, which is in the art department, and I hope it always stays there, is concerned about that. And I think it's worth our while. For instance, we always have had those courses addressed primarily to elementary art ed, and frequently our doctoral candidates will take those courses, will teach them. I think we need to have that. From the selfish point of view, the art ed group, it's useful for us to have to teach those courses and to prepare material that we think is valuable in their terms. And also because after all, you see, there are a lot more art teachers than there used to be teaching in the elementary schools. Now, they need to know the elementary setup, and they need to know something about dealing with children at that age level. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
Sure. At the time the elementary program was getting underway, or at least the committees were formed and that sort of thing, was a period, as you mentioned before, when a lot of new faculty had joined up, and it seems to me there was rather somewhat of a gap. There were quite a few faculty who had begun in the 20s,
yes,
who were on staff, not very many who had come on during the 30s,
very few,
and then a lot into the 40s. Was there some sort of a was there any sort of gap on the between those two groups in terms of how they looked at the formation of an elementary ed program in any way?
I really don't know, because the people, the older people I knew, knew well and had great respect for were Arvo Bar and Matt Willing in particular, and Clarence Ragsdale I saw less of. Well, that's about it. Those three were the great people, it seemed to me. And of course, no one of those three people would look down their noses at the effort to have an elementary education program. On the other hand, they were, all three of them were men who were really more concerned, you might say, with the philosophical aspect of education. Matt Willing definitely is a philosopher of education. Barr was more of a statistical, research-minded kind of person. But none of the older people were specifically in the programs of the elementary education. Now, some of them were concerned with this, like Gladys Borchers in speech. Because Gladys, along with Phil Weaver, the father of the former president,
John Weaver,
she had written texts, although I imagine her texts and Weaver's texts were primarily addressed to the senior high school, probably were. But still, Gladys did some work in the elementary school, as far as I know. But you see, a lot of the curriculum and instruction people, or what used to be the old education thing, it was definitely all oriented toward Wisconsin High School. And one of the first things that John Guy tried to do and failed utterly, because we just didn't get any cooperation from the city at all, what has now finally become La Follette High School, not La Follette, the other one.
Memorial.
We really wanted that. We wanted the city to nominate that as a teacher training high school to be operated in part with the aid of the university and to take the place of the old university high school. And the new superintendent, I forget who that was, cross-grained creature who came up from Oconomowoc would have nothing to do with it.
And superintendent of schools in Madison.
Yeah, he succeeded Falk. You see, a very different attitude came into administration and into education with the death, with the departure of John Guy Fawkes and Phil Falk as superintendent of Madison schools and so on. You got this new breed of cat with the computer machines and lots of staff and all the rest of it. Maybe they're all necessary. I'm not so sure that they are.
No.
Because you used to, for instance, I used to play student teachers as my job. Once a year I called up Phil Falk. I'd say, Phil, we're at the point of placing our teachers. Do you have any word for me? Oh, no, Fred, glad to know you're still in business. We're still in business on our end of the line. You just get together with Ruth down there in the union and work out whatever schedule is best for you both. And so I'd call Ruth Alcott, and she'd come down, we'd have coffee in the union, work out a teacher training program for the semester. And it wasn't all that different from what it is now.
Yeah. No, well, on paper, the program today looks very much like the program did when you first created it.
Sure. And we didn't have to go through all this nonsense, you see. We didn't have the... Now, I admit, part of it is protection of the schools from the public. You know, you have to be so careful that you're not suable and all this.
Yeah.
But they're all of these things, and the elementary ed program was thought of in those terms, was more a matter of people just getting together and working out some of these problems. you'd go along so far, and then suddenly somebody'd say, well, we're sort of running into a snag here, you know. It might be, maybe it was Helen White. Helen White was sort of a positive-minded lady. And that was another thing. We had the stars of the liberal arts people who were on these committees.
Yeah. This is, take a little sidetrack here, but this relationship of LNS to the school of education has changed radically.
I'd say it has almost ceased to exist.
Yes. And people like Helen White are not remembered as being part of the school of education. I mean, they're remembered for English, like Pooley, John Noland in zoology.
Yes.
People like that. And yet they were intimately a part of the important major things that were going on in school education.
Very, very much so.
Somewhere, that kind of thing stops. Now,
Helen White sat on our committee to form our MFA.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not there just for the fun of it.
I doubt it.
She was there because she thought that the English people had a possible wish someday to have a Master of Fine Arts. She was there because it was important to her what the art people did. And we had people of that sort. Rudolf Langer was frequently on our committees. Lowell Noland was often on our committees. Who was the great physicist? Name began with R.
Not Rollinson. No,
yes, isn't it?
Raleigh Rollinson?
Is he still here with us?
He's emeritus now.
Well, that's the man. Yes. He was on committees.
He taught me.
School of Ed.
He taught me physics.
Well,
beautiful man.
He was on committees. I've been on committees in the School of Ed with him.
Well, that's something I want to pursue further. I guess about it.
So, you see, the whole thing was an effort which John Guy very much wanted to see go through. To prepare elementary school teachers who had a better, more cultured, liberal arts background. That's what it amounted to.
Are you saying that the program would not have started in elementary education without the pushing of Fox?
Well, I don't know if that's true or not. I do know that it couldn't have gotten very far if Fox hadn't approved of it.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that he did hire Virgil Herrick to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was initiated by Fox.
I never knew Mr. Fox, but from what I've heard of him and from Otis, the general commentary of different people around, might say that, well, one reason perhaps the School of Education did this was a simple matter of empire building rather than a tremendous need for it. And I mean, what would you, if someone made that argument to you, what would you say? Would that ever occur to you?
Well, Fulks was a man who wanted very much to be a power and to achieve things, to accomplish things. He was, however, a very loyal, a devout University of Wisconsin person. And I think he felt that he had achieved his empire when he was named dean. Now, to say that he was an empire builder would assume that he wanted to somehow to extend his holdings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he did that. I think he wanted to make the School of Education one of the most excellent schools of education in the country. Now, that isn't quite the same as empire building.
Right. Well, from what you're saying, the relationships of the School of Education and the Madison Schools and DPI from the period, during the period when Fox was dean, were almost, it was very collegial, very cozy, very much a sort of let's put our heads together kind of thing.
Yes.
You seem to be indicating that if there's empire building, it's occurring after Falk has gone after Falk's is left.
I am not as familiar in a sense with that, but to go back a little, Foulkes was hired by the College of Letters and Science. Matt Willing was hired by the College of Letters and Science. All of those old people were hired by the College of Letters and Science in a department of education. There was no school of education until 1931. And at that time, they developed a school of education. Now, the school of education has become a very large integer, as much larger than some others, but nobody thinks of the School of Music as being away from LNS.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thinks of the School of Journalism as not being in LNS. And Foulkes never thought of the School of Education as not being in LNS. Now, do you see what I mean?
Yes.
And he held to that very strongly. He always invited this group of very high-powered, important national persons to the School of Education meetings. He made a very great thing of that. You couldn't go to a major committee without finding one or two or three of those people on the committee. And he said, we are a part of the College of Letters and Science, and don't you forget it, and I'm never going to forget it. Now, I think we have, as we have gotten bigger, it isn't so much a function of maybe of people not wanting to, although I think that's part of it. I don't think many people in LNS care anymore. But this group we're talking about did care.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it was important to them, to the College of Letters and Science. They prepared teachers for the secondary schools of Wisconsin. They felt that very keenly. And they wanted to know what went on in the so-called specifically teacher training courses. So the attitude was a very different thing.
Yeah. Well, I have just a few more questions having to do with elementary education creation. There's sort of loose ends that I have. I think it was a note, according to the one documents I found back in November of 1949, if you could place it like that. There was a big hearing on this elementary education project.
Yes.
Do you remember what that was about? And I found, see, the thing is, there's supposed to have been minutes for it, but I don't have minutes. I just have some of the documents that were handed out to people. What happened there? Why was
I
that
probably
necessary?
Have those things. And my mind is not clear. I do have some old folders. The only thing that comes to my mind now is that this probably, I was probably there, and I suspect it was, in fact, it's slowly coming into my mind that it came about from something like this, that people like Professors Nolan, White, and many of the others we've named, had said, now, we're very much interested in this. We think very highly of it. We're hoping that all will go well and that it is organized. But we're hearing some rumbles from our colleagues. And it seems to me that it did start in something like that fashion. And so John Guy had said, well, why do we not have a hearing in which we invite all members of the College of Letters and Science and of the School of Education, indeed any member of the university staff, to come to the hearing and to give them an exposition of how far we have gone with this thing, so that it will be all open and above board. In fact, I have it almost in my mind that John Guy said, of course, any member of the faculty is free to attend any committee meeting they want to come to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wasn't just nonsense on his part,
mm-hmm.
because time after time, he made that point not only about the School of Education, but he made it about the art department under certain circumstances. We had one member of our department who was very prone to wanting to do things off in corners. And Foulkes was a great believer. If you wanted to put something through, you did it out in the public, where God and man could see you and knew what your motivations were and what you had in mind.
Uh-huh.
So I think that was it.
Do you remember, well, either through the course of this hearing or within your own committee, were there any areas of debate or, you know, that stand out in your mind? I mean, this shouldn't sort of accumulate some sort of consensus.
Well, I think there were a number of us who felt, as I did, that it was a very optimistic program. We did wonder whether it could work. That to begin with, you needed to get awfully good people from the high schools, superior people, really, people in their top quartile or thereabouts, if we were going to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And there were going to be other problems, as we saw it. There would be problems if you got such a superior group of people who would, in those years, have been primarily female. No matter how much we wanted men in it, it would have been mostly women. There would be problems when it came to their student teaching. They would have difficulty with the advising teacher. Well, I mean, what you were proposing was a whole step up in preparation before they got into the program, and then in preparation in the program, at least a different preparation. Whether it was better or not remained mm-hmm. to be seen. So many of us knew that if it worked, it would have problems. As to whether it would work or not, indeed, that was another question. I do know at one time or another, somebody said, well, maybe we ought to have the kind of thing they've tried to do in the farm so much, Future Farmers of America.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to get back to... And I guess there were such things in high schools,
Future
Teachers
of America.
There needs to be more of that, more of a preparation of some high school people to believe that teaching is not only available, but a most interesting occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't have time to go into that. It was agreed that these things would be problems. Some, there's still problems, without a doubt.
Somewhat along that line, I have a quote from the, I think the report they put out at that hearing in 1949, the preliminary report, and one of the quotes says, "It is not the intention of the committee to propose large numbers of special methods courses in each of the minute subdivisions into which the curriculum of the elementary school might be organized."
Huh.
And then, say somebody from my perspective having to go through the program might say, gee, you know, it seems like you proceeded to do just that. You seem to cut the curriculum up into all kinds of little separate methods areas because, you know, you take this method and that method.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
What's your reaction?
Well, I remember when it came to our special area, as for instance, art, the problem in those special areas was one which didn't seem to me terribly difficult, because I felt all along, and I still feel, that a good semester's course, let's say in painting or drawing, for a group of prospective elementary teachers, with an emphasis on how one develops in drawing or painting, is both an introductory course to the graphic arts and an introductory course to a means of approaching it. Now, I have never been able to see why we can't do that, and indeed I think I can do it and have done it time without number in my classes. That Eagle River course I talked about was primarily a group of elementary school teachers, most of whom had one or two rather sad little courses in art.
Mm-hmm.
So, since this was a nature study thing, we drew and we painted trees and water and plants and bugs and all the rest of it. It's not hard to teach people to draw quite adequately.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, I emphasized the way that one went at it, how not to expect too much and not to expect too little of themselves or of children or anyone else. I think we overdo it in these things. we overdo it in drama, we overdo it in music. Mm. Yet, people who are in the elementary classroom need to have some concept of an approach to drawing, to a little music, to some dramatic work. Isn't that true? Mm. Now you can't expect them all to take 8, 10, 12 credits in each of those areas.
Right.
It's out of the question. Mm. But if they had a one semester experience that was fairly rewarding to themselves and gave them a bit of an opening into the area, I think that can be done. Mm.
I think one last question for now. Somewhere between the beginning of the elementary ed program itself, somewhere about 1952 or 3, and about 1955 or 56, a number of changes were made in the program, particularly in terms of required courses and number of credits required for professional education. There was a bit of an inflation there, but I think the credit levels jumped from, I think originally 37 to 40, or 37, from 37 to 40 to about 55 credits.
In professional education.
In professional education, and in required course areas, that is health education and that sort of thing that were added on sort of
uh-huh.
later on. Was there some debate about that at the time, or why did that happen? I mean,
I wasn't as active in those years as I had been earlier, and I do know, feel very strongly, that in these latter years we have gone back to an awfully tight bookkeeping kind of system, and I think the State Department has been particularly bad that way in the last 4 years. I think their requirements of this so-called social awareness kind of thing,
human
relations, the fact that everybody must take an elementary reading course, pretty soon everybody will have to take an elementary math course, no matter what they teach, and so on. It seems to me that the Department of Public Instruction, and therefore the elementary education departments, not only here but everywhere, are taking the view the teachers are not prepared for this or that or the other. Every time they say that, they want to add 2 or 3 credits to a required coursework. And I think that's exactly the wrong way to go at it. I think that what we had in mind in the late 40s, early 50s, was to try to prepare an elementary teacher with a good liberal arts background and attitude. Now, if an individual comes out with an effective liberal arts point of view and has learned anything in college, they're not going to be a Nazi or a vicious person to other persons in social relationships. If they don't know how to teach reading, they will at least have a concept that the child needs help, not badgering like an adult might. I just feel that the direction is all wrong again. We're plastering credit upon credit upon credit every time we feel a weakness somewhere,
mm-hmm.
or every time the public begins to get all hot and bothered about something. Well, I think right there is our problem when it comes to reading.
The television?
Certainly. How much reading did you do as a kid?
A lot.
Well, did you have television in your house?
Yeah.
Did you read for fun?
Mm-hmm. I was unusual, though. And
well,
my parents especially encouraged me by example, shall
uh-huh.
I say.
They did or did not?
My father watched television a lot.
Yeah. Well, I read. I read all the time. But I read for fun. I read junk, you know, adventure stories mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing.
I was a Civil War buff.
Well, I went in for that, and I got to be old Mark Twain and
mm-hmm.
all these crazy old school books, stories about English schools. I got started on that, and old Henry and all that sort of thing. But I think it's the reading, the reading, the reading. It's It's a far more liberalizing and enlightening thing than that can ever be. Mm-hmm. I think it is. I feel certain that it is. And yet the children, the families... well, you see, this was worked on, really, most of it, before television had become that powerful.
Right.
Now, our kids are 30s, 35, 40 years old. Well, they never saw television until after they were out of college, that is, in their house, in our house. Mm-hmm. So they read a lot. And I think that's part of our problem. The State Department is trying to make up for all of the family deficiencies and the television deficiencies and everything else by credit hours. Well, that is a different thing. And of course, we were dealing in this elementary ed committee with literally a pre-television generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's rather different, probably, in our outlook.
It is different. It needs all doing and rethinking over again in terms that are presently facing the teachers. And I just don't know what teachers... Most teachers probably don't do much reading anymore either, elementary teachers. I suspect there aren't many who do.
Okay, this is January 25th, I believe, and we are back onto the interview. I would like now to ask you if you could sort of pick up from where we left off, in the sense that we had sort of left you at the beginning of your tenure here at Wisconsin and had explored your role in the elementary education program, but now perhaps you can relate more of your experiences about the art department itself and your experience in being chairman of the department.
Yes, well, earlier, or in the last tape, we had gotten to the way in which the whole department was changing over considerably in the summer of 1946. The faculty members then were, of course, Helen Annan, who taught design and watercolor, Della Wilson, who taught courses in art education, predominantly in art education, who worked with Ruth Alcott, who was then teaching art in Wisconsin High School, and Rollin Stebbins, who was a Boston-educated painter. He taught the courses in life drawing and in painting. He had a course in portraiture, which we have never repeated since he retired. Then, in addition to those people, there had been Mr. Barnum, who died in the summer of 46. He had taught graduate seminars and a course in metalcraft. One of the rather curious episodes of that summer was that Barnum died after classes had been going for 2 weeks. And in his course in metalcraft, there was Arthur Viertaler, who was then teaching in a junior high school in Madison, teaching art in a junior high school. So Viertaler took the class as teacher for the remaining 4 weeks and gave everybody their grades, including himself, and then became a member of the faculty for the fall term. And two other people who became faculty members had just completed their master's degree with Varnum in the seminar. And those two people were Alfred Sessler, who had come from Milwaukee State Teachers College in the September previously to do his master's degree, and Robert Grilley. Now, Grilley was still a graduate student as well, but he had been released from the Army early enough so that he had been on his graduate work. I don't know whether Grilley had come in February of 46 or whether he had been released from the Army as early as September of 45. But he had been an Air Force man and had flown bombing missions from England. Later on, as it developed, we had another bombardier on the faculty, that's Gibson Bird, who was not an officer but had been a tail gunner on one of the big flights. So we had Viertaler and Grilley and Sessler on the faculty. Now, Sessler had completed his master's degree. Viertaler and Grilley had not yet. But they were all listed simply as instructors. In addition to myself, I was taken on as an assistant professor. And George Adams Dietrich was taken on as an assistant professor. And he taught sculpture. And there was one other person, William McCloy. And McCloy taught drawing and painting as well. I think he taught a course which we still carried called pictorial composition, but I'm not sure of that.
Well, let me...
Now, does that get all the people that you have on your list?
I think, yes, of the initial ones.
Uh-huh.
Let me ask a couple things. When I talked to Russ Hostler about how it came that he was brought to the faculty and the procedures for interviewing and things like that, in your tenure as chairman, could you describe the process by which you picked people to join the faculty and that sort of thing? That's a rather interesting bit of business.
Yes. Well, the way they did it in 46 was catch as catch can, and that, there was no question about that. Except, I think, for me, because I was thought of as a person who was in considerable distance away from having been a student, and I had been chairman in the Milwaukee department, so that I was given some pretty thorough interviews. The entire senior faculty would sit in on interviews. John Guy Fawkes was very much interested in the appointment. One of the things that he did, and I came to appreciate that considerably thereafter, was to question me very rigorously for an hour or more on what I knew of the whole field of the arts and art education as far as the whole country was concerned. And at first I wondered if this was not just stuff to take up the time. But later it came out that he did fully expect us to become a department of real concern, because he realized, I think, that the enrollment was going to go way up and that there was a chance here to make a really significant department. Now, I don't mean to say that it hadn't been a significant department before, but it had been small. And he realized that if we doubled the faculty, one of the things we would immediately do would be to add a great many more activities in terms of courses, which, of course, that did turn out to be the case very quickly. Now, as to the way in which faculty were chosen after that kind of rush of August and September in 46, from there on we did have faculty committees, and these were set up quite carefully. And of course, since I was chairman the first 2 years, no, I was not chairman the first 2 years. I was a faculty member only in teaching with the graduate committee. Miss Wilson was chairman the first year. But that had been when the department was at its very low ebb of enrollment because of the war. There would be very few men in the student body and not very many women. So she really had not had a great pressure of business. Well, now suddenly she had twice as many faculty people to account for, and perhaps four times as many students, and room arrangements, a great many things that she simply hadn't had to cope with. And she had expected that I would be chairman.
Mm-hmm.
She had told me I would be chairman. We then went up to Dean Anderson, and he said, no, the chairman had to be elected by the faculty, and she, Professor Wilson, had been elected by the faculty last May. She was therefore chairman. So what I did do that year was to act to some degree as an assistant chairman. And we had a very good secretary, Scotty Lamoureux, whose husband later went to Texas for his doctor's degree and took the family with him, of course. So with Scotty's help and Miss Wilson knowing, of course, how things should be done, where they should go, I did take care of a good deal of routine work of the sort that took a lot of office attention, because she simply couldn't handle it. She was teaching a full schedule. They had never thought at that time that a chairman should have time off for being chairman.
Mm-hmm.
She taught a full load of classes. So we got along one way and another that year, and then the next 2 years after that I was chairman. Well, what we did was set up committees. First we took somebody who was in the field that we were looking for. Say we needed a new person in drawing or painting. We would usually have somebody who was active in drawing or painting as chairman of the committee. I think we never had Mr. Stebbins.
Hmm.
He wouldn't do it. So we would have one of the younger people. And then we would have at least two others. So that would be three people in a committee. They would write the letters under the name of the chairman of the committee, and then they would review the people whose papers came in, and we got enormous numbers of applicants, of course, in those days. One thing that was happening was that a lot of men, and a very few women, who had worked on the old WPA painters and sculptors projects all wanted to get college jobs. The war was over, the WPA was over, they had no place to turn to.
Mm-hmm.
So we had many of those people applying. As it turned out, we didn't hire very many of them. Once in a while we would hire one of them for a summer session only. The reason we didn't hire them was that we didn't have the money, we didn't have a professorial tenure jobs for them, and we didn't have the kind of a program they wanted. They wanted to be a part of the university at a relatively high salary, at a permanent tenure basis, and with a relatively small group of graduate students.
Mm.
We simply couldn't meet those requirements. And furthermore, we didn't think we wanted to. That is, we felt that anyone who came in should carry a fair load of classwork. But we did hire our successive new people very carefully, and I think the fact that so many of them are still very much with us and have a very good status, Middle West and nationwide, proves that we didn't do too badly.
Mm-hmm. Did you tend to go after particular people when you needed to fill a position, or did you more or less just announce a position and wait for people to come to you?
Well, at first, we missed one person on that roll of September 46,
mm-hmm.
Dean Meeker.
Oh, yes.
He was the last one, because we didn't realize until almost the times classes had started that the enrollment was going to be so large, we needed one more person to teach drawing. So I was actually up here working on registration. When Miss Wilson came around, she said, we're going to need one more person. I wish you would look through all these papers. That's what brought it to my mind. We did work very strongly through the Chicago American College Bureau for applicants.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, as we got to know more people in the Middle West, we worked through university heads of departments a great deal. But at first, in 46, we worked a great deal with the American College Bureau and Fisk College and others like that. But what you also do when you get those bureau people is that you look through the papers and you see who the people were that the applicants list as their sponsors. And that was the case with Meeker. Mm-hmm. Because we had, from Meeker, some excellent recommendations from the Chicago Art Institute, and one from University of Chicago in History of Art. So that people that we knew already at the Chicago Art Institute were saying, here is one of our best young people. As a matter of fact, when Meeker came up, he was still a student, we discovered. Because he had started a master's degree partly through the Chicago Art Institute, partly through University of Chicago, and partly through Northwestern on the downtown campus. And actually, he took a number of courses here with Oscar Hagen in art history to complete his master's degree work.
Mm. How did the university's administration, the main administration, receive your adopting people for positions who were still students and then even some of them had master's degrees and that sort of thing?
Well, I'm sure that Dean Foulkes looked upon us somewhat with a jaundiced eye at first, because he didn't know how this would work out any more than we did. But the fact is, we were going to have 18,000 students or something like that on campus, and they had closed the spring semester with 8,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the hassle at that point was to have enough teachers simply to teach the courses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact that Wirthaler taught that course in art metal, well, at that point in time, Wirthaler knew as much about art metal as anybody we could have found.
Mm-hmm.
There was only one outstanding teacher of art metal who had come into the Middle West at that time, and that person was over at Cranbrook, and they had hardly been there more than a year or so, and they hadn't produced some outstanding graduates yet.
Mm-hmm.
And Wirthaler was an extremely excellent craftsman, had actually carried the craft work of it far beyond that which Mr. Barnum tended to do with his students.
Now, when people came up for tenure, I suppose, which would have been a few years later in the early 50s, a lot of these people, then, of course, they probably made up the bulk of the department, so it's kind of in some ways a loaded situation, but at that point, you weren't quite under so much pressure to meet enrollment demands and that sort of thing. Was there a movement to try to take another look to see if there's someone better, or did you put more weight on their considering them because of credentials and that sort of thing?
Well, first of all, promotion was very slow still. Most of them like that. Meeker, Wirthaler, Grilly, Wilde, all instructors, you see. We didn't hire people as assistant professors the way we now do. They were just instructors. So it took them 3 years in most cases even to be appointed as assistant professors, which is still not tenure.
Right.
And I would say that none of us made associate professorship in less than 5 to 7 years. So we had 5 to 7 years before they began to come up for tenure.
Now, is that generally the rule in the School of Education as a whole, or was that more or less peculiar to your department?
Peculiar to the department at that time, because you see, in the School of Education, they were still getting doctoral degree people almost entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this assumed that they had to hire them as assistant professors. We hadn't yet gotten to the point where there was a kind of degree the equivalent of or considered as such. Nowadays, for instance, We almost never hire anybody who hasn't had some teaching experiences in colleges and who doesn't have a Master of Fine Arts. Now, Master of Fine Arts in most reputable college institutions takes from an absolute minimum of 2 years, and that's seldom possible, to much more often 3 and 4 years beyond the baccalaureate.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the earlier schools in the Middle West to add the MFA degree right here. But none of that had happened at that time. Now you say, on what basis were those people later, most of them, kept on in tenure? Well, on the basis of continuing with their work and continuing to be accepted in major exhibitions, certainly of a Midwest caliber, and wherever that is available on the caliber of a national exhibits. So that really none of that group hasn't succeeded in staying with it. We did have people after that time who have come and gone, quite a few. I must say that many of them have gone to other institutions and done equally well.
I know that there is a bit of a discrepancy, say, in the way people in Phi Ed were treated in terms of merit increase and promotion, that sort of thing, as opposed to people in other departments, at least later on. That was that also noticeable in the art department?
Well, I think so. I think you would have found over the years, especially those first, say, 10 years from 46 to 55 or thereabouts, that art and Phi Ed were not treated, either men's or women's Phi Ed, were not treated as well as the other elements of the School of Education, and certainly not as well as LNS.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that simply reflected what had been done since, say, 1911, 1912, when the Department of Art had been, well, it wasn't the Department of Art, but when that subject began being taught, it was thought of as a minor element in the Department of Education, which was just a part of College of Letters and Science. That is, it was thought of in something of the same view as is still true, let's say, in the College of Ag, where you have people who are both, let's say, superintendent of some of the physical accommodations and also who teach a course or two.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the university then, I think not as much now, tended to think of someone who dealt with tangible materials as being not quite so much of an academic bigwig.
Right. Did the people, you know, at the higher levels in the School of Education, in the dean's office and that sort of thing, did they tend to apply different criteria for acceptance of merit increase and promotion as did the people in the art department itself? And did either or both of those groups adjust themselves over the years to the other point of view?
Well, the only person in the School of Ed who had anything to do with it at all was, of course, John Guy Fawkes. Where John Guy was a dean, he was the person with whom you dealt. And on the whole, I think John Guy did really very well. He tried very hard to become familiar with the art department and with the positions that we took on faculty people, with the terms of excellence that we developed. He made every effort to learn and to understand what it was all about. Now, having learned, he was not an easy man to deal with. He would say flat out to someone who came in to protest perhaps their promotional level or their salary level, he would just say, "You have not been set high in the category by your own colleagues. Now you tell me why you are a better artist and art teacher than they say you are."
Mm-hmm.
And he was not easy to deal with in those terms.
Did you ever lose people as a result of that?
Oh, yes. We did. We had a fairly rugged time for a few years because John Guy pointed out that it was up to departments to make the original recommendation on salaries and on promotions. It still is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for some years, because we were all bunched so closely together, assistant professors, instructors, and so on, we all met on everything.
Mm-hmm.
This was quite disturbing to the several professors. That would be Annan, Stebbins, and Wilson. But John Guy had said, we've got to do it this way. Everybody meets. Well, when it came to evaluation, the annual evaluation, we just wrote everybody's name down in a line and had everybody write their evaluation of them from 1 to 17 or however many it was, and then compile the score.
Wouldn't always seem satisfactory.
It certainly didn't seem satisfactory to those who wound up down toward the bottom. And we did lose one of our people in about a 5-year period on that score.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a person who never exhibited, refused exhibiting. There was no way of judging this individual's work on any basis outside of his own judgment. And we had good reason, very strongly, to doubt his teaching, because there was almost nothing but a constant succession of people wanting to be out of those classes and even to be excused from basic requirements in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, he left.
Let me ask you, if you can, if it's there, to make a couple of contrasts, perhaps. Could you contrast the way that you, the relationship of the department with the dean's office under Fox, as compared to the way things worked with Stiles and McCarty, for instance? Is there a contrast?
Oh, yes, there's a pronounced contrast, partly in the style of the men, but much more in the fact that I think it's safe to say the department had grown up the style with Faulx, so that by the time Dean Stiles came, he took it for granted that he had a major art department that was widely known throughout the country and that he was very proud of.
Mm-hmm.
Which he was aware of, was very happy about it, the same thing with McCarty. I think both men had some pleasure in being dean of a going major art department. At least that's the impression I always had from both of them.
But the
thing had been accomplished.
Yeah.
It was John Guy who had been, so to speak, in at the new birth.
Right.
Well, it was a new birth, and this is not in any way to discredit the people who were with it, as Della Wilson was from 1911 on. It had been a relatively small adjunct of a very easygoing period in American education, when less than 20% of the high school graduates ever got into a college.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 46, the world turned topsy-turvy as far as colleges were concerned.
Mm-hmm. There was an incident that you may know of that occurred in the early 50s concerning merit increases within the Department of Education involving Mr. Ragsdale.
Yes.
It was a rather spectacular little bit. Now, one of the points that he raised was that he claimed that the administrators, Faulx, and even university administrators tended to interfere in the department's parsing out of funds and that sort of thing. I don't know if you ain't know anything about that, but
well, I did some, yes.
You can elaborate about that, and then did anybody in your department in art find that sense of things going on? Were people feeling that the administrators were trying to impose themselves a little bit on them and hurting departmental and individual autonomy?
Well, first of all, anybody in any department in the university who feels that they haven't had a good deal in the usual passing out of promotions and salary raises, or salary at all, blame somebody.
Right.
They blame their colleagues, if their colleagues did have a noticeable impact on it, and certainly in the art department they had to blame their colleagues because we all had a very positive impact on it. And then secondly, they blamed the chairman, whom they felt hadn't told the story very sympathetically, and finally the dean. Now that's just
mm-hmm.
the way it happens in any hierarchical institution, whether it's the army or a hospital or the university. There was less reason in the art department for their feeling that way. People did feel that way at times. I say there was less reason because John Guy, and certainly Stiles and McCarty after that, have always felt that the evaluation of the art department is something that with which they are not too familiar. So when it comes to evaluating a person on their contribution as a working artist and as an effective teacher of art, they have never assumed that they could outguess the department.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once in a while, I would be outvoted and the department would be outvoted when the department would say about somebody, well, this person has not been terribly effective, they haven't exhibited a whole lot, or they haven't done this or they haven't done that, but we mustn't be too hard on them. John Guy's attitude when he ferreted out something like that, he would say, has this person done this? Has he done this? Has he done this? If the answer had to be no, no, and no, he would say, well, then
mm-hmm.
here. In other words, he had absolutely no concern with being too generous to someone who hadn't really measured up very well.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you can't afford it, and if you think you can, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
He made a very clear point. He said, if you're too generous to people who haven't been doing their job, then there isn't money enough to do something for those of you who have been
right.
doing your jobs.
Right.
But on the basis of trying to be an art judge, no.
Mm.
Now you see with Ragsdale, or with some of the other people in education who really had major hassles, of course there, the deans are men who know what's going on. They are in their own element. So they can not only be dean, they can be professors of education. And that is a different thing.
Right. Another contrast I'd be interested to have you make was that, well, I have a definite sense, I think, now of how you judged faculty and how you went about selecting people
mm-hmm.
in your early period. And then, of course, there were some structural changes in credentials and that sort of thing that occurred since then. Has there been, in your experience, a change now in more recent years in the way faculty tend to be evaluated and the way you tend to select faculty as opposed to the years past?
I think so, and one thing that I don't like very much and feel that it isn't as good as it ought to be, I think in the present decade there hasn't been enough emphasis upon is a person a good teacher or are they interested in teaching. The emphasis has been, is this person a productive artist and are they likely to bring some kind of glory to the department because they're a producing artist? And nobody even raises the question, have they been effective as teachers? Now, I feel that this is not a good thing. as long as I was chairman, if no one else raised it, I always raised the question, what has this person's teaching experience been, if any?
Hmm.
And what kind of comments do we have on it?
Can you elaborate on why you think that has happened this way? I mean, are there particular people in the department who haven't shared your feelings, or where do you see the change?
Well, I think the change is now having to shift back. I'll get to that a little bit later.
Okay.
But I think the shift was very evident, say, in the period from about 1960 through the 60s and on up until perhaps very recent years. Maybe it's been changing just a little bit in the last two or three years. I think the reason for it is that the same reason as this kind of thing is happening throughout the university. I think the university and many faculty people in the university have forgotten their chief role, which is that of educating who knows how many, 28,000 undergraduates. I think a great many people are primarily interested in the teaching of those young women and young men who are going to do what they do, that is, be artists.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the bulk of the people whom they do teach, in sheer number, are people who are not going to be artists or biologists or historians or anything else. They are going to be educated people, one hopes. And I think that the art department went along in that same trend. One teaches freshman and sophomore and junior classes because one must. One teaches the graduate courses because there are your children.
Mm-hmm.
Your disciples.
Right. Have you noticed, is that the kind of attitude that is mainly present in faculty who have been hired in that period, or has there been a change also, so to speak, in the faculty who came in more with you, and you know, have they changed over the years in their perspective, do you believe?
Well, I think that depends very strongly upon the individual person.
Mm-hmm.
About a year ago, there was an article in the paper about John Wilde. Did you happen to see it?
No.
You know anything of John of Wilde?
Not that much.
Well, Wilde is an impeccable draftsman, one of the finest persons that you might know in the country who draws the human figure. And he's a tough, hard-boiled, demanding Germanic person. He will not teach graduate school. He teaches freshmen and sophomores and some juniors and seniors drawing from the model, preferably. But not necessarily. Even beginning freshman drawing is from objects and the like. Well, in that interview with Wilde, they quoted a student who said the thing he liked about being with John Wilde as a teacher was that if you took Wilde, you got Wilde. If the class began at 8, he was there before 8. If the class lasted until 10, he was there until 10. If it lasted till 12, he was there till 12. Lasted till 3:30 or 3:40, he was there till that time. And he was there all the time, and he worked with you, with every person in the class, to teach them how to draw in the way that Wilde felt an artist should draw.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now John has been... He was one of Watrous's students here on campus. He's been on the faculty since 1946. And this is 79, so he's been on the faculty all that time. He doesn't change much. He likes the same schedule. He likes to teach the same things. But obviously, anyone who is in John Wilde's classes gets John Wilde teaching. Careful, competent, thoughtful, demanding. That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Now, the crucial question is, a person like Wilde, obviously a very high caliber, but yet, has he been penalized?
Oh, no.
For that?
Indeed not.
Okay.
He is the name professor in the department. The department has recognized John's contribution. However, I would say that there are a number of people in the art faculty who take the opposite point of view, mm-hmm. who work very hard with a very select handful of students and who are much too careless about the general run of students who come and go. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, one of the reasons I think this will be changing, and according to Phil Hamilton, is now changing, is that we don't have the number of major students we had. See, up through perhaps 274, 5, 6, we were told by the chancellor to take only people who had a major in art, because he didn't want to increase the department. We had classes absolutely filled. People would go to him, "We need more faculty." He'd say, cut down your enrollment. Just first take all those people who need an art course to graduate. Well, I can see that in not trying to add to positions, because they knew that this other period was coming. On the other hand, it did force the department into not being a department where many, many people get some art experiences. Now we're going back to that, mm-hmm. because Phil tells me that the enrollment is about 60% art majors and 40% non-art majors, mm-hmm. which is, was more often than not, that has been the way it has been.
Well, this sort of leads into another question I had. I was going to ask you to describe the process of selection of students, and both at an undergraduate sort of way and for the graduate work mm-hmm. that you had in the 40s, and then perhaps when you finished that, perhaps contrast any changes that have occurred mm-hmm. that way in recent years.
Well, we never really have had any way of selecting undergraduates. Mm-hmm. They enroll and we try to get them in. One point that I have always made, and of course since my major field for my own teaching is in art education, I tend to go in that direction. Dr. Quinn, who's director of the Counseling Services School of Ed, did his doctoral on this problem. We made some selections of groups of people in three different graduating classes 10 years apart. And it came out very clearly in that study, and I think it would come out in any study you might make, that the people who have stayed put and graduated in art almost invariably come to a university art department because of the influence of an unusually good teacher of art in high school. That is, the ones who want to major in art. I think that's still true. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't select them. They select themselves.
Right. Do you make any, the university obviously tries to publicize the existence of its art department or whatever, so on and so forth, or maybe not, I don't know.
We haven't done much of that. Now, in the 50s, we did a good deal of it because we were, it was growing. We didn't perhaps need to. But I have always felt very strongly that we ought to help the people in the grades and in the high schools. So in the 50s, for a number of years, we had a select group of exhibitions which we made available to senior high schools as loan exhibitions of student university work, and we did circulate a good deal of that at that time. Now, I don't think we're doing any such thing as that now. I wouldn't be too surprised if people begin to do more of those things again, because this is the thing that happened. In 1946, which is the year that I came here, as we've been discussing, there was one art department in any of the normal schools. That was Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. That is, that had a four-year major. All of the rest of the schools, Oshkosh, River Falls, Stevens Point, Lake Cross, etc., seldom had more than two art teachers. They taught only one or two courses for people who might teach elementary school. There was no other art major in any of what we now call the Wisconsin State University campuses. Today, every one of those schools has at least six or eight art people. Many of them have as high as 20. So you have 12, 14, how many are there? Major art departments in the state. Mm. In state schools, not to say anything at all about the private colleges. Of course, the population is big, but it isn't that much bigger. So with this coming slowing up of students, many of those departments will have to become far more interested in courses that the general student will want to take. Mm-hmm. I think that's good, myself.
How about graduate students? Now that's a different story.
Well, the graduates, we still are quite heavy on graduate students. We really have three kinds of graduate students. There's the MFA people who hope to teach in colleges. Now that hope is pretty thin right now.
Well, can you go back though and say, contrast the way in which you chose graduate students or how you selected them,
mm-hmm.
say, in 1946 and relate changes that have occurred over time?
Well,
what did you expect?
In 1946, first of all, we just started with whatever was the general university policy as far as grade point was concerned, and that was about all. In the first place, we didn't feel competent, nor did we feel that it was something we could do to deny a GI student entrance. So for a number of years we did really very little. Then as the GI period wound to a close, well before that we began slowly. First we just asked for them to enroll in the graduate school as all of the schools asked. And then I just can't put a hand to when we began to ask for evidence of work, but we did begin to ask for photographs. And then, of course, nowadays the best possible thing to get is the 2x2 color slides, and that the coming of the color slide that was adequate and easy to do has changed the whole business of people applying for graduate status.
Mm-hmm.
So that where we used to ask for portfolios, primarily of drawing, paintings, possibly photographs of larger things, we now ask for color slides. At present, the emphasis on the faculty is on color slides. And I think that's wrong. I think there should be color slides, there should be overall grade point average and standing in class, and there should be recommendations from their undergraduate professors. They get all that material, but they pay very little attention to it.
In other words, right now they look mainly at their artistic work.
What they feel is the quality of their work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my feeling is this. I could name, if I went back through our old student enrollments, I could name graduate student after graduate student whose work on the undergraduate level wasn't very interesting. But their recommendation from people that we knew was very, very strong, and their grades were very high. We would take such people. Now, often those people needed longer time for their graduate degree because their artwork hadn't really been all that good, but their headpiece was good. And many of them finally left after perhaps an extra year of graduate work as among our most superior people.
Mm-hmm.
we aren't even taking those people anymore.
I see. So that you're saying in the 40s and 50s, you put a lot more reliance on grade point and on recommendations.
I'd say we tried to put an equal emphasis on all three,
mm-hmm.
the work, the grade point, and the references. Now, I stayed, as a matter of fact, as long as I was chairman, I did really act as graduate advisor. When I quit being chairman, I pointed out that we were now getting so big in this area that we really needed a graduate chairman. So then I became graduate chairman for one third of my load, and so I continued to process these things until 64 when I went to England. Now, at no time did I take all those actions alone.
Mm-hmm.
We always had a graduate committee. But in my submitting those things to the graduate committee, I always had these three elements very carefully planned out for each of the three people, each person. Again, I feel that this thing of emphasizing those students who make a rather quick maturity as undergraduates is a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them fail desperately in graduate school because that's as far as they can go. They aren't really very bright people.
Mm-hmm.
They've learned to copy a major professor.
Mm-hmm.
So I say grade point and personal recommendation should be as important.
Has the graduate school student body been filled primarily by Wisconsin people then?
We've always, I would say that from the early 50s we began to attract a very substantial group of people from outside the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nowadays we attract very few, for instance, from Milwaukee.
Yeah. One more contrast before we shift back while I'm thinking of it. You were chairman of the department a long time in its earlier formative years. Could you contrast the role of the chairman in the department when you were chairman as opposed to what you see the role of the chairman has been in the last 10 years, say? Has it changed in any way? Is it the nature of the position?
Well, it, of course, as the faculty has become larger, it has become more difficult, and that has made a difference. This is one of the problems, as I see it. Now, I became chairman in 47, and I stayed to, 58, wasn't it?
Right, there was a break in there for a couple of years, apparently. Or were you continuously chairman?
No, I was continuously chairman. No, there was a break, 3-year break, Mrs.
Mm-hmm.
Annan. 47 to 49. And then Mrs. Annan came in. They were beginning to be a little bit upset by the young Turks, as they felt.
Who was they?
The elder citizens.
Wilson and Annan.
And Stebbins, yeah. And so they were getting very unhappy about things. They elected Mrs. Annan. So she was chairman 3 years. Then I picked up again. I would be 51 or 52. 51, I guess, to 58, wasn't it?
52, 58.
Well, the problem with the administration of the art department is that it lacks continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for it is quite evident. It is a major department, and unlike an academic department, the problem for the chairman is a